Exodus 16, 21 to 36. Each morning everyone gathered as much as they needed, and when the sun grew hot, it melted away. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much, two omers for each person. And the leaders of the community came and reported this to Moses. He said to them, "This is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow is a day of Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. So bake what you want to bake, and boil what you want to boil. Save whatever is left, and keep it until morning." So they saved it until morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink or get maggots in it. "Eat it today," Moses said, "because today is a Sabbath to the Lord. You will not find any of it on the ground today. 6 days you are to gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will not be any." Nevertheless, some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather it, but they found none. Then the Lord said to Moses, "How long will you people refuse to keep my commands and my instructions? Bear in mind that the Lord has given you the Sabbath. That is why on the sixth day he gives you bread for 2 days. Everyone is to stay where they are on the seventh day. No one is to go out." So the people rested on the seventh day. The people of Israel called the bread manna. It was white like coriander seed and tasted like wafers made with honey. Moses said, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Take an omer of manna and keep it for the generations to come, so they can see the bread I gave you to eat in the wilderness when I brought you out of Egypt." So Moses said to Aaron, "Take a jar and put an omer of manna in it. Then place it before the Lord to be kept for the generations to come." "As the Lord commanded Moses, Aaron put the manna with the tablets of the covenant law, that it might be preserved. The Israelites ate manna for 40 years, until they came to a land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. An omer is 1/10 of an ephah. Our culture values, even venerates, work is seen to be someone of significance. You know, people don't mind as much when busy people are late because, well, they're more important, aren't they? We're expected to be busy. Our culture wants us to work hard. The ideal mum is seen as someone who has a successful career, fulfilling hobby, the perfect home, not to mention taking her children every day of the week to some extracurricular activity. She's able to host the best dinner parties, always looks like the model on the front cover of Vogue, and never gets ill. The perfect dad is expected to be the top guy at work. He's expected to coach his child's team. A marathon runner with a personal best not far off 2 hours, an excellent cook, a wizard with the dishwasher, the hand drill, the vacuum cleaner, and every other power tool that money can buy. These are the kind of expectations that our culture puts on us. Now, life is demanding. Life has always been demanding. Ever since the fall, when we were told by God that we would eat food by the sweat of our brow. It is hard work to live life. We are not to be lazy. But our society is rather like those Egyptian slave drivers with their ever-increasing demands. At that time, it was the dictate of Pharaoh. Stop supplying straw for these slaves, these Hebrews, but they need to produce the same quota of bricks every day. Today, overwork is demanded by our economy that relies on overtime, that worships hard work and money. God set the Israelites free from their slave drivers, but their mindset also needs to change. They'd only known work. Day in, day out, for hundreds of years, they had worked from dawn to dusk, producing the same quota of bricks, ever-increasing demands. They were exhausted, they were groaning, they were burdened. But now, God is their master. They have been freed by the mighty power of God. And the pattern of work that God gives to them is very different. We're going to see what this means for them and what it means for us. I've just got two headings today. It's the afternoon. Can't be expected to listen to three headings, can you? First heading, God gives a weekly day of rest. In Egypt, the people had to go out every day to gather stubble and to do so for other people. Here in the desert, as God's people, they go out to gather food, not for other people, but for themselves, for their own families. Pharaoh made them slave away every single day of the week. God provides them with food and gives them a day of rest. For 6 days, they gathered the manna. We saw this last week. Gathered up what they had, plenty, they had sufficient. None of them went hungry. Now, they had to be up before the sun grew hot, because as we saw, the sun, when it got hot, would melt the manna away. They had to collect it each day, because if they didn't, if they tried to keep it over to the next day, it went off. And so they did have to work. It's taught in Scripture, the person who doesn't work will not eat. There's no place for laziness. But there was the opportunity for rest. So on the sixth day, they were to gather twice as much as other days. This had been told to them right at the beginning. Look back at chapter 16 here and verse 5, when God first gives the manna. On the sixth day, God tells Moses, they are to prepare what they bring in, and that is to be twice as much as they gather on the other days. And so this is what they did. We come to verse 22. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much, two omers for each person. Well, the leaders, who must have forgotten what the instructions were, go straight to Moses and say, look, what are the people doing? They've gathered twice as much as they normally do. And so Moses takes the opportunity to teach them about the Sabbath. Verse 23. Moses said to them, this is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow is to be a day of Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. So bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil. Save whatever is left and keep it until morning. God gave them this Sabbath rest. It's such a contrast to Pharaoh. Turn back to Exodus chapter 5 and verse 5. Where Pharaoh says, look, the people of the land are now numerous and you are stopping them from working. Or literally, you are making them rest from their work. Pharaoh does not want them to rest. God, their new Lord and Master, he gives them rest. And he does this by providing more for the people on the sixth day. He provides enough that they can gather for 2 days. And not only that, he preserved what they gathered on the sixth day so that it didn't go off and they were able to eat it on the seventh day. And furthermore, he didn't give them any manna on the seventh day, as some who didn't obey God's command found out. They went out on the seventh day to gather manna, but they found none. Then the Lord said to Moses, how long will you people refuse to keep my commands and my instructions? Notice how he puts it in verse 29. Bear in mind that the Lord has given you the Sabbath. This is God's gracious provision for these people. Once they had been slaves, now they are free. Once they had to work constantly, now they're able to have some rest. But the people need a new mindset. They need to see God's goodness in giving them far from the Sabbath rest being a day of hunger, they could eat all that God provided. Verse 25. Eat it today, Moses said, because today is a Sabbath to the Lord. And there's a sense of joy in that. Eat it. Look, this is not a day of drudgery. This is a day of celebration. This is a day of rest. Eat it today, all of you together. Eat it. Verse 30. The people rested on the seventh day. It's such a positive thing, isn't it? They're able to eat together as their families. They're able to rest together. And that sense of joy on the Sabbath day, even though it isn't explicitly mentioned here in Exodus 16, though it's certainly implied, we see it more clearly. Let me just read to you from Isaiah 59 and verses 13 and 14, where the prophet Isaiah speaks about the Sabbath day and the joy that it should have been to the people. If you keep your feet from breaking the Sabbath and from doing as you please on my holy day, if you call the Sabbath a delight and the Lord's holy day honorable, and if you honor it by not going your own way and doing as you please or speaking idle words, then you will find your joy in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride in triumph on the heights of the land and to feast on the inheritance of your father Jacob. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. This was to be a day of joy, of joyful rest, a provision that God gave to the people. Later, of course, the Pharisees, when we come to the New Testament, the time of Jesus, the Pharisees had turned the Sabbath into a day of drudgery. They had turned it into a day with 101 different rules. Make sure you don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other. And they spent their time thinking, oh, I can't possibly do this, I can't possibly do that. And instead of being a delight and a joy, the Sabbath had become just a burden. That was never God's plan. He wants people to rest. He wants it to be a joyful rest. Now, was it only the people of Israel then who had this blessing? I don't think so. We too can enjoy a weekly day of rest. We too, like Israel then, as we'll see, can look forward to what this points us to. And we'll see this a bit later. But it wasn't just for the people of Israel then. Some think, well, it's just part of the law of Moses. Well, actually, this comes before the Ten Commandments. The people were given manna before they came to Sinai. And the fourth command itself says, remember the Sabbath day. It was something they already had. It was not introduced by Moses at Sinai. And actually, here in Exodus 16, though a lot is said about the Sabbath rest, this isn't the first mention of it, because it comes right at the beginning. In Genesis chapter 2, this is where the Sabbath was first given. Genesis 2 and verse 3, right at creation. Genesis 2 verse 2, by the seventh day God had finished the work he had been doing, so on the seventh day he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. Why did God take 6 days to make the world? Surely he could have made it in 6 seconds if he wanted to. The reason given to us in Scripture is that God was setting the pattern for us. He's been described as like the heavenly craftsman going about his daily work. The morning and the evening were the first day. And he saw what he'd made and it was good. Like a craftsman who's produced his work for the day. And for 6 days, God creates. By the seventh day, he's finished. And he rested. And so God blessed the seventh day, made it holy, because on it he rested from the work of creating that he had done. That's when God introduced the rest, the Sabbath rest. Though it's not mentioned again until we come here to Exodus 16, actually, a seven-day week was, by all implications, observed from the beginning. Do you remember the story of Noah? He's in the ark, he sends out the dove, takes it back in, he waits 7 days. Another time, he waits 7 days. The implication is that they had a seven-day week. You come to the story of Jacob and his wives, and how he was given Leah, and he really wanted to marry Rachel, and Laban says, well, fulfill her week, or literally her seven. They had a seven-day week. And so it was there before we come to Exodus 16. Jesus, referring to creation, says in Mark chapter 2 and verse 27, the Sabbath was made for man, not man, for the given to mankind right at the beginning, a weekly day of rest, given for the good of all mankind, set by God's own pattern when he created the world. Like marriage, which was also given at creation, it's a blessing for all people, for all time. And like marriage, it points to something greater. But it's still a blessing here and now. I find it fascinating that this pattern of one day of rest in seven just works. After the French Revolution, which of course was a revolution against everything that was to do with the king and religion, and so they got rid of their monarchy and they got rid of anything religious. And part of that was to get rid of the seven-day week. They introduced a 10-day week. And they tried it for a few years, and it just didn't work. That secular experiment was a failure. In 1929, the Soviet Union introduced what they called a continuous working week, which was a kind of 5-day cycle, but different people were on a different cycle. It meant that the factories could be going every single day. They didn't stop for Sundays. They also thought this would stifle church attendance, because if half the family are having to work on a Sunday and half have days off and people don't have the same day off, it will make church attendance. Of course, it made family life more difficult as well. Who wants to have a day off when they're the only person in their family with the day off? And again, it didn't work. By 1940, it was abandoned. You can't improve on God's pattern. 6 days you shall work, one day rest. Given by God for the good of all mankind. Now, under Moses, as you come to Sinai, we find that there are added regulations that the people of Israel were given. It became a Jewish Sabbath with extra rules, extra sacrifices. There were other Sabbaths as well, religious festivals and new moon celebrations. These things came under Moses. As Christians, we're not under Moses. That's not the sort of Sabbath that we need to keep. We don't keep a Jewish Sabbath or those Sabbaths, new moons and festivals. Actually, our day of rest is now the first day of the week. That's why we read the story of the resurrection on the first day, the Lord's Day as it became known in the book of Revelation. The day when Christ rose, when Christians met. Now, there are differences of opinion as to exactly what this should mean, how it works out in practice. I'm thankful that in our culture, Sundays are still a little different, that most people don't have to go out to work. And I think we should see this as a blessing. I want to encourage you to value this blessing that we still have in our culture, even though it's even though it's not the same as it was a generation or more ago. But let's be thankful that we are able to have this blessing of rest. I want to encourage in your families, fathers, lead your families in this. Every family is going to have a different approach. I'm not here to say you've got to do this, or you mustn't. I don't want to be a Pharisee, but I want you to see the blessing of this day of rest. And I would just add this. Just as the Israelites could trust God to provide for them so that they didn't have to go out and collect manna on the seventh day, so we can trust God to provide for us. When I was a student, and I was a student for many, many years, I never would study on a Sunday. Often I had an exam on the Monday. I don't think it affected adversely. To the contrary, different studies have shown actually students who take one day off a week do better than those who just plug away every day. My second heading, Jesus gives eternal rest. We've seen the weekly rest that God provided. Now we think about the eternal rest that Jesus gives. The last part here of Exodus chapter 16, it kind of looks ahead. So a sample of manna had to be kept for future generations to be able to see. Verse 32, take an omer of manna and keep it for the generations to come so they can see the bread I gave you to eat in the wilderness when I brought you out of Egypt. The implication is that they weren't going to have this manna all the time. It would be for a limited time. They needed to keep some so that future generations could see what God had so wonderfully provided for the people. This miracle of food was not to be forgotten. Nonetheless, by storing it, it anticipates a time when they'll no longer be in the wilderness, no longer will they have to go out every morning for 6 weeks to gather their food. Wonderful as this provision of manna was, there was something better to come. They were going to enter a land flowing with milk and honey. Something better than manna. Greater variety of food, abundance of food. The manna and the gathering of it was just a foretaste of something better. And then this comment is made. Verse 35, the Israelites ate manna for 40 years until they came to a land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. Again, okay, this is Moses writing later. He wrote like the book of Deuteronomy just before they enter the land. So presumably Exodus was written by him at that time as well. And he's able to add this comment. The manna lasted all that time until they reached the border of Canaan. God provides for them. They're entering that land flowing with milk and honey. And entering that land was often put in terms of entering rest. Could turn, if you like, to Joshua chapter 21. And this is just one example in the book of Joshua where it talks about the rest that God gives to them as they enter the land. Joshua 21, verse 44, the Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their ancestors. Entering the promised land was to enter rest. No longer the manna, but the abundance from a land flowing with milk and honey. No longer the hard work, but rest. And so what they have, that one day a week of rest in the wilderness, helps them to see that they're going to enter the fuller rest in Canaan. And I think we can see here a picture, can't we, of the eternal rest that we will have. We're like those Israelites in the wilderness. Canaan, like heaven, that eternal rest that God has promised. A fuller rest awaited the people in the promised land, just as a fuller rest awaits us who believe in Jesus. But there's something more, isn't there? Because really every page of Scripture points us to Jesus. We didn't find difficulty seeing Jesus in this manner, because he is the one who gives living bread. He is the bread of life. Next week, when we come to water from the rock, we will see Jesus is the one who gives living water. But can we not see Jesus here? As God gives the people rest, are we not reminded of Jesus who said, "Come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened, and I'll give you rest"? Isn't this a picture for us? A wonderful, powerful picture. What a contrast it was from their slavery and drudgery and burden and groaning in Egypt as slaves to God who gives them food and gives them rest, even at that time. And so Jesus is the one who gives us true rest. There is a spiritual rest that we can enjoy here and now, our eternal rest in glory. Yes, we strive, don't we, against temptation. We are wearied by the bad news around us. Don't you find it exhausting listening to the news sometimes? Sometimes it just weighs us down. There is so much that is burdensome in this world. If we're in the midst of a difficult situation at work or in our families or with our neighbours, don't we feel the weight of it? That's this world. That's the burdensomeness of this world. And we see the effect of sin all around us, and we see its effect within us too. What a heavy burden. You know, Jesus was heavy with sorrow as he went into the Garden of Gethsemane. He was burdened with the sin of the world as he went to the cross. He bore our sin. He carried it. What a weight. What a burden. He bore that burden for us. As someone who volunteers to go on the difficult mission for other people who are in trouble, so Jesus went willingly, taking this burden for us. His mission was to bear our load. Maybe you've been on a hike and someone is getting tired and so exhausted they can't carry their rucksack anymore. And you say, "I'll take it for you." Their burden is lifted. They're able to carry on. Think of your burden of guilt. Think of the shame that you and I feel because of our sin. Think of the burden of those difficult situations we sometimes find ourselves in. He took our load. He took our sin. He took our guilt. He took all the demands that the law makes against us, that tells us to do this and this and this, and we fail and we fail and we fail. And he took it all. He took it all. He took my sins and my sorrows. He made them his very own. He bore the burden to Calvary and suffered and died alone. At every step, he felt the weight. At Gethsemane, he struggled to go on, but he did. He took all that sin, and it was nailed to the cross. He has lifted our burden. And he says, "Come to me, all of you who are burdened and weary, and I'll give you rest." You carrying burdens today? You're carrying sin and guilt. You do not need to carry that burden. Whatever you have done, whatever weighs you down, whatever guilt troubles you, it is a burden you do not need to carry, because Jesus has carried it. And he's nailed it to the cross. And he's defeated it. He's paid for it in full. That's why we began with the confession. We can confess our sin, whatever it is that we have done, however we have failed God, we confess and he forgives. Come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Are you burdened by the expectation of other people? Are you burdened by the responsibilities laid on your shoulders? I want you to see that Jesus is the great lifter of burdens and the giver of rest. Now, this isn't to say that he calls us to a life of inactivity and laziness. Far from it. But he says, take my yoke. You see, his yoke is so different to the yoke of Pharaoh. The yoke of Pharaoh would grind you into the ground, would destroy you. That's what Satan does. That's what this world does. Our whole economy revolves around that. Literally, people have to work for our economy to be maintained. They have to overwork. It shouldn't be like that. But that's the way it is. It will grind you down. And Jesus says, I can deliver you from the expectation of other people, from the responsibilities that are too great for you. I will help you. I will be that one with you. Take my yoke. Walk with me. Know my strength. Even in the midst of a troublesome, difficult life, we can know true rest in our hearts. Rest from sin. Complete deliverance from guilt. The condemning voice of the law and the expectation of others. When you take Christ's yoke, when you do what he gives you to do, he will give you all that you need to do it. Jesus gives true rest. Let's pray.